When I was a teenager, I was pretty insecure, just like every teenager is to some degree. And what I found out was that if I could convince really pretty girls to like me, then I'd feel better about myself. And so that began kind of this process, this journey, this lifestyle of promiscuity, of casual hookup culture, of self-identifying as worthwhile because I could influence and use other people as objects to make myself feel better about myself. And so I started to abuse pornography and relationships and my sexuality. And for a while, it felt really good, and I felt pretty good about myself, and it was pretty exhilarating. It was fun. You're just a young ball of hormones just exploding all over the place, and so I felt really free and really good. A couple weeks ago, I was shooting a wedding. My company, we like do photography, videography for stuff. So we're doing a wedding. And the day before, I talked to my wife and I said, hey, look, like it's going to be a 14-hour day. It's super long. I had a bunch of stuff I really want to do, but I'm not going to be able to get to it just because it's been a busy week. Can you just help me out and do a couple of these things? So I text her the things I just need her to get done. Then I go shoot the wedding, come home late at night. Feet are sore. I'm tired. I'm hangry. And I walk into the garage and I see that she hasn't done one of the things that I thought that I had asked her to do. And at first I was like kind of frustrated, I was upset, I was angry. But then all of a sudden something like clicked and I started to realize something. I went, oh, hold on a minute. I was like, this is my chance. I was like, I texted her and asked her about this. This is the day that I'm finally going to win an argument. I have her cornered here. So I take a picture of it. I'm like gathering all my evidence up. And then I'm like marching up the stairs. Now I'm happy. I'm not upset anymore. My feet don't hurt anymore. I'm marching to the bedroom. I'm like, here we go, Craig. Today's the day you lay down the law. You know, today's the day you stand up for yourself. And today's the day you win that argument for the first time. It's been 4 years, way too long to go under this kind of slavery and oppression. I love my wife very much. Today's the day, and I get into the bedroom, and she's asleep, and so I look, and I go, tomorrow's the day. Tomorrow's the day that you're going to win this fight. Okay, so I get changed, and I climb into bed, and I wake her up as I'm getting into bed, and she goes, oh, hey, you're back. And I go, mm-hmm. I'm not going to give her an inch. And she goes, are you mad at me? I go, mm-hmm. She goes, was it because I forgot to do that thing that you asked? Mm-hmm. She goes, I'm really sorry. I just had a busy day, crazy stuff, whatever. And she goes, do you forgive me? Mm. And then I roll over and I just squeeze myself right to the edge of my side of my back drawer. I was like, there's going to be no room in this bed for you to misinterpret any level of forgiveness. This is a cold sleep you're going to have tonight. Couple minutes later, I'm sitting there, and I'm like, you know what? I'm actually not that comfortable, like, on my side here. And actually, why am I being punished for this? Why am I only taking up 1/10 of the bed? This is my bed, too. I should get 50% of it. And so I'm like, you know what? This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to roll over onto my back, and I'm going to take up my rightful amount of bed. So I do that. A couple minutes pass, and I'm like, I'm actually not that comfortable on my back. And usually when I go to sleep, I like to sleep on my side, and I actually like to hug her and hold her, and it's just nice to, you know, have that. And so then I'm like, okay. This voice pops up in my head and says, don't do this, man. It's like, this is how they beat you. This is how they win. They just wait it out. And they just, and so I was like, okay, no, you're right. I'm not going to do that. So I just lie there and I'm like, I'm just going to hold this out. And a couple minutes pass, I'm like, I can't do this. I can't lie on my back. And so finally I cave and I turn over and I grab her and I hold her and I pull her in. And one of the things we usually do before we go to sleep is we pray, but she's pretending to be asleep at this point. And so I just say this, rattle off this little prayer in my head. And as I'm kind of going through, you know, thank you for this, thank you for that, whatever, God just stops me. And I'm just met with this comparison all of a sudden to what my life was like then when I was a kid, just immersed in this empty, flat, sexual wasteland, to what my life is like now. And even though I'm mad at my wife, even though there's whatever going on, that I still want to just climb over and hold her. That I come home after a day and I know there's someone waiting for me there who loves me. That there's intimacy, there's trust, acceptance, that she knows me. And I think to myself, wow, how did I think I was free back then? How did I think that that was better compared to what I have now? And I wondered how much better would it have been if it wasn't for all the damage that I caused myself, because it took years of counseling and therapy and journaling and praying and rebuilding trust with her and all this hard work. And I thought to myself, if I was so free back then, why was it so hard to break free from that lifestyle? If you're a teenager in this room today, I want to talk to you just for 1 minute, specifically because teens, once you hit 18 years old, there's a 93% chance if you were a guy that you were going to watch pornography. If you're a girl, it's about 50 to 60%. Of that group of people, 71% of you report that you think that you successfully hide it from your parents. And the average age of exposure is about 11 or 12. I was 11 years old. And possibly the most troubling statistic of them all is that of all the minors right now who are watching online pornography, about 20 to 25% of them are under the age of 10. They haven't even had a double-digit birthday yet. See, when I was growing up, there was no shortage of youth leaders and parents and pastors all telling me that porn was bad and porn was wrong and you shouldn't do it, don't do it, it's not good for you, but nobody ever took the time to tell me that Jesus was better than porn. That what Jesus had for me was better than what I was in. And it's not just a teenager issue. A month and a bit ago, and you might have heard the story already, somebody came, I was preaching, so I was practicing here on Saturday night. Someone came and dropped off a bag, and so I go outside and I look and I'm, what's this? And it's filled with porn magazines. This older gentleman driving away. So I go and I throw him out and I come back in, but he wrote this note that he put on the bag. And he wrote, "I am a slave. I am a slave. My master is in this bag. He has controlled me since I was little. Can you and your church please pray for me?" This isn't just a teen issue. And actually, it's not just a porn issue. What this is it's a slavery issue. What this is, it's an idol issue. It's things in your life that you turn to or that hold you captive and that you root your identity in them. And they hold you in bondage, in slavery. Today, we are talking about the topic of God's promises. We're in a sermon series right now. We're going through all of these different promises, and today the promise is that God will set you free. God's promise is that God will set you free. He will set you free from those things that keep you in bondage, that enslave you, and that hold you back from living the best life you could ever imagine in Him. And I think you need to hear this for a couple different reasons. The first is that right now there's a cultural conversation happening, especially on kind of like the university level. And I don't want to get too deeply into it, but there's like this resurgence of socialism and neo-Marxism and all this kind of stuff going on. And you're going to hear about it at some point in your life. You cannot escape it. And one of the things you need to know that's happening is that freedom is being redefined right now. Freedom is being redefined as having no restrictions or oppressions over your life, that you have nothing holding you back from doing whatever you want and living whatever kind of life you want to live. And right now it's being rephrased, this ideology is emerging that young people and by huge hordes and masses are buying into, that the greatest thing that they could ever do for themselves is just throw off every level of restriction and oppression and anything that holds them back from doing what they want to do, from living the life that they want to live. And sooner or later, your kids or your friends or your coworkers or your classmates in university are going to come to you and they're going to say, "You aren't actually free. You're not free because your faith is holding you back because there's these rules and these laws and there's these standards that you have to follow. And that's holding you back, so you're not actually free." And I want you to, one, not fall for that lie, but also be able to have an answer for that. And some of you guys need to hear this today because you're not a Christian. You don't follow Jesus. You're here. Maybe a friend invited you or you're like listening to me online somehow. And you are looking at these weird Christians who live differently than everybody else. You're looking at these weird Christians who give their money differently than everybody else, who handle their sex lives differently, who their attitude around their depression and anxiety is just different and they just seem different and you don't understand why. And you need to know that those people are people living in the freedom of Jesus. And that's their secret. And some of you need to hear this message today because you are a Christian, you do follow Jesus, but you look no different than the people who don't follow Jesus out there. And you're missing out. You're missing out on the life that God has for you. Today we're going to be looking at John 8. So if you have a Bible, you can turn there right now. John 8, we're starting in verse 31. While you're turning there, at this point in the story, in the Gospel of John, Jesus is an adult. He's in his ministry. He's kind of going around from town to town. He's preaching, he's teaching, and people are really interested. There's huge crowds, and they either hate him or they love him. And so at this point, he's in a Jewish kind of area, and he's been preaching and making some claims, and this is where we're picking it up from. Verse 31. To the Jews who had believed in him, Jesus said, so he's speaking to this group of Jews who believed in Jesus. He said, if you have a pen, underline that word right there. If you hold to my teaching, you are really my disciples, then you will know the truth and the truth will set you free. This is interesting because this last part of the sentence implies that Jesus thinks that even though they believed in him, that they were still enslaved, that they still needed to be set free. They answered him, "We are Abraham's descendants and have never been slaves of anyone. How can you say that we shall be set free?" What they're really saying is, why should we need to be set free? We're not enslaved. Jesus replies to them, "Very truly, I tell you, everyone who sins is a slave to sin. Now a slave has no permanent place in the family, but a son belongs to it forever. So if the son sets you free, you will be free indeed." And finally, he goes on to say, "I know that you are Abraham's descendants, yet you are looking for a way to kill me." And underline this last sentence right here, "because you have no room for my word." Because you have no room for my word. The first part of this clump of verses is painting a picture of a group of Jewish people who believed in Jesus, who had some level of transformation. They something up here clicked. They were nodding along. Yeah, okay, Jesus, that sounds good. Sure. And then they're going, yeah, okay. And there's some kind of cerebral, mental, intellectual transformation, but there was nothing down here. There was no heart transformation. There was no formation in their spirit. I think there are two things that we can observe from this. The first comes from verse 33. They say to Jesus, "Jesus, we are descendants of Abraham. We have never been enslaved. How can you say that we need you? How can you say that we need to be set free?" They had no conviction that they actually needed Jesus. "We have never been slaves. We don't need you." The second thing that we can look at is in verse 37. Jesus responds, "I know that you are Abraham's descendants, yet you are looking for a way to kill me. Why? Because you have no room for my word." This group of believers had no room in their hearts for Jesus' word. I think the Western church struggles with this a lot because we have a lot of people who come to church and who nod along to the sermons. They go, yeah, sure, sounds really good. And then they look like Christians and they kind of believe and they act kind of like Christians. And it seems like they've bought into this idea. They believe, but there's no spiritual transformation in their hearts. And what we find is we have a giant mass of believers who are not disciples. And Jesus, looking at this crowd of Jewish believers but not disciples, raises the bar for them. And he says in verse 31, "If you hold to my teachings, you are really my disciples." See, we're bad at this in the church because we love to fill the seats. Feels really good when there's a whole room full of people, because even if I can only make a couple of you laugh, if there are a lot, it feels like a lot of people are laughing along to my jokes, and it feels like the room's really full. And then I get to put on the annual report when I put it out for my communication stuff, that we have all these people that come to church and all this money that we give and all these really good things, and it looks great. But the greatest lie that you could ever believe is that if you just come to church, if you just give, if you just serve at soccer camp, if you just work really hard not to sin, not to mess up, and you just work really hard to be a good person, that somehow that's going to get you into heaven. Do not fall for that. The core issue of these Jews in this moment is found in verse 33. This is at the very core of their hearts. This is the issue. We are Abraham's descendants and have never been slaves of anybody. We do not need you. And so when Jesus challenges them, when Jesus pokes at the thing that they define themselves with, this group of Jews, they point to their bloodline. They point to their laws and how hard they work to uphold them. They point to all their rituals and their traditions and how hard they have strived to justify themselves. The scene now shifts from the state of this Jewish group to Jesus. And he says in verse 34, Jesus replies, "Very truly, I tell you, everyone who sins is a slave to sin." The Bible was written in a different language. This part was in Greek, and then we translate to English. And so sometimes things don't fully come across, and we just have to explain them just a little bit more, the fullness of it. So when Jesus says, everyone who sins is a slave to sin, he's not talking about that terrible thing you thought about your kids this morning when you're trying to get them here on time. He's not talking about that time you stubbed your toe and said a word I can't say from up here. He's not talking about those kind of things. He's talking about a better translation of this would actually be everybody who practices sin. Everybody who is in it. Everybody who lives and who follows and immerses themselves. Everybody who is in habitual sin is a slave to sin. And what I think is interesting in this moment is that Jesus chooses to focus in on the sin of slavery. I mean, he could have gone for the political, he could have gone for the economic issues, he could have gone for all these other things that we personally spend so much time on caring about. But instead, Jesus focuses in on the sin. And when they say, we have never been slaves, Jesus, well, they're obviously wrong. The Jews have been slaves so many times in history. And even in that moment, you could have taken that Jewish crowd, reached into their pocket and pulled out a gold coin with Caesar's face on it, representing political and economic slavery over them. But instead of Jesus focusing in on their political slavery, instead of Jesus focusing in on their economic oppression, Jesus shows us that he focuses in on their spiritual slavery, and in doing so reveals to us that he is not interested in coming to politically revolutionize the world. Jesus didn't come interested in bringing about some economic shakedown. Jesus came to liberate us on a spiritual level. One commentator I was reading about this verse wrote this: Jesus regarded the master they most needed saving from not to be their economic or political oppression, but rather their self-centeredness. These Jews did not need saving from the Romans, but rather freedom from themselves. Verse 35 continues, "Now a slave has no permanent place in the family, but a son belongs to it forever." That doesn't make a ton of sense to us, but it would have made perfect sense to them. And the reason why is because back then what would happen is when you were a son, you'd get married, you wouldn't move out like we do here. You would actually just build onto your father's house and you would join into the family tribe, right? Just get bigger and bigger. You join the family business. It's usually farming and stuff like that. And so that's what you would do. Then that's kind of how you would live, and you would just be a part of your family unit. Now, if something bad happened to you, if you got sick or someone died or you just weren't born, you're born into poverty or whatever, you had two choices. There's no government to take care of you, so you could go sit on the side of the road and die, or you could go to one of these bigger families that, you know, is more well situated, and you can go work for them, and they'll provide for you, they'll pay you, and they'll give you a housing, and they'll, you know, take care of you and feed you and all those things. And so when we read this, it's like, oh, a slave, like we think of, like, you know, the Civil War and the rights movement and all that stuff, that kind of slave. And it'd be better just to understand it as like a bond servant or like an employee. And so Jesus is painting this picture here of this home in which there are workers who earn their keep, and then a son who's part of the family and does not need to do anything to belong to the house. 26 goes on, and he says, "So if the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed." There are two promises here that I want us to work through for a moment. The first promise is that God will set you free into new life. God will set you free into a new life. And if you're not a Christian here today, this is really important for you to know, because this is a core piece of what we believe. And this is, and so hopefully you're here because you want to learn, what is it about these Christians? What do they think? This is a core element of what we believe. And if you are a Christian, if you do follow Jesus here today, this is incredibly important for you to know, because this should be, needs to be at the core of our identity. And so maybe you already know this, and this is a great reminder, and maybe this is going to be the first time you're going to hear this, and I hope and I pray that this would be the first day of your new life, your free life, and this would be a changing point for you. Let me set the stage a little bit. In the beginning, we read in the Genesis account that God created the world, and it was good. And so depending on, you know, there's a lot of different ways you can read the Genesis account, and I'm not going to get into that, but God created this garden, and it was a plethora of abundance. And not just like physical abundance, but it was actually this amazing picture of family, of belonging, of being known, of walking hand in hand with God in open relationship and with one another in open relationship. And it was beautiful. And then what happened? There was one rule: do not eat from this tree. And what did we do? We ate from the tree. And it was more than just breaking a rule, though. It was outright rebellion. It was this black thing in our hearts that said, I think you actually know what's better for yourself than what God thinks is good for you. And it was a full-on rejection of God and his role on the throne. And we took him off of the throne in our own hearts, and we put ourselves on it, and we rebelled against him. And so what we did is we fell short of God's standard, and we continue to this day to fall short of God's standard. And I think it's important to understand God's standard here, because I think a lot of us really struggle with this notion, especially in kind of the culture we live in. I was talking to one of my buddies a long time ago, and we were talking about, you know, are you going to heaven, and what does that even mean, and whatever. And I asked him, do you think you're going to heaven? He said, yes. And I said, why? He said, well, because I'm a good person. And I said, according to who? I don't know if you guys have ever watched Wonder Woman. Gal Gadot, Chris Pine. If you don't know who Chris Pine is, just ask your wife, because he's got the most gorgeous set of blue eyes I have ever seen. And I can say that because my wife has brown eyes. This movie, Wonder Woman, I won't ruin it for you, but it's set in this like World War kind of era. And so Chris Pine and his buddy, they have to get into this like German gala to steal something. And so they go steal a German car, and they get into the German outfits, and they look like Germans, they sound like Germans, and they're driving down this like this bridge over a moat, and they're getting up to the gate. And all of a sudden the driver looks back to Chris Pine and he says, they have invites. All the other cars that are ahead of us, they have invites. That's how they're getting in. And even though he sounded and looked like a German, he didn't have an invite. Now, no matter how dreamy your eyes are, no matter how many self-invites you write yourself, that's going to make you feel really good, all right, up until you get to the gate. But it doesn't matter what you think the standard is. We fall short of what God has set to enter into the gate. We have sin in our own hearts. We rebel in our own hearts. And you don't have to look past yourself to find that, but if you look into this world, you'll find no shortage of evil that we have caused. And this is where Jesus comes in, because Jesus lived the perfect life. And that doesn't just mean that he didn't sin, but it actually means that he was righteous. And we kind of struggle with this one, because we always focus in on Jesus paid for all the sins, and that's true and that's good. But also Jesus was righteous. He lived a life that was right, that was good, that pleased God. And so when you come to Jesus in faith, when you profess him as both your Savior, you believe, and your Lord, you're a disciple, he welcomes you into his house. He welcomes you into his family. And then one day when we stand before God in a courtroom and he judges us and he judges the world, Jesus will walk into that courtroom and his whole family, his whole household will come in behind him. And as he stands and walks up to God, God will smile at him, at his righteousness. And he will turn and he will point to everyone behind him in his household and he will say, they're with me. They're coming in. And it is not simply just because sins were paid for, but actually because righteousness is there. and not your own, but Jesus's. And this is incredibly important. And this is why it's not just about, this is why you can't just show up to church and be a really good person, try really hard and not sin, because that stuff doesn't matter. It's not the point. And if it is the point for you, then what that means is that your identity is rooted in what you are doing or what you have done to earn this and not what Jesus has done. Which means that you're no different than this group of Jews who point to their hard work, who point to their traditions, who point to all the things that they have done to justify themselves. See, you must be genuinely convicted that you need Jesus, or you will have no room in your heart for his word. And the promise of this new life is meant to actually liberate us. It's meant to free us from the responsibility of doing all those things. We don't actually have to earn this stuff anymore. We don't have to work hard for it. That doesn't mean we don't strive to live a good life, that we follow Jesus. And I'll get to that in a minute. But what it means is that we're free to live under the righteousness of Jesus and no longer pressured to perform to be accepted by Jesus or God. The second promise is that God will set you free to a better life. God will set you free to a new life in him, and God will set you free to a better life than you could ever imagine. When I was prepping this message, I was going through the scripture and praying over it, and I hit verse 35. It says, you know, a slave has no permanent place in the house, but the son remains there forever. And God just spoke to me in this moment as I'm reading this verse, trying to figure out what does this mean. And he said, Craig, you were a slave. You were a slave in this house. And then I set you free. And then you went back to being a slave. Because you feel as though I will not love you if you do not work for it, if you do not earn it. You feel as though you need to earn my love, and I gotta be honest with you guys. I am petrified to stop being a slave. Because I think deep down in my core, I actually don't believe that God would love me if I didn't work for it. And I think some of you here in this room are in the same boat. I think some of you here in this room work yourself to the core, and you slave over how well you take care of your children, and you slave over how much work you do and how much money you give and all these things and all this performancism, and you're captured in this perpetual cycle of performance. And deep down somewhere, really far in that heart, you are convinced that you wouldn't actually be loved if you didn't do something to earn it. God wants to set you free from that. A little bit earlier before, Mason was talking about the fact that we actually adopted into his family, that we are sons and daughters of his family. See, the slave, the bondservant, the employee, the worker in the house, he has to work to earn his keep. And his place is temporary. But the son doesn't have to do anything. He simply belongs because he is part of the family, because he is loved by the father, because of he is the father's. And that's an identity piece that some of you in this room, myself included, God knows, need to be set free from. Some of you in this room, you're scared to give up something in your life. You're scared to give up a lifestyle that you lead, that you live, because you're unsure of what God has for you, and you're not actually sure that what God has for you is better than what you have for yourself. Some of you think that what you have for yourself is better than what God has for you. And I need you to know something right now. I need you to know that God knows you. But more than that, that God actually made you. He created, he designed you. He knows exactly your personality, your sense of humor, what you like to do, what your passions, your skills are. He designed you that way. He knows what you are made for, and he knows what you are not made for. And the best possible life that you could ever lead is in the freedom of Jesus. God set you free to a better life than you could ever imagine for yourself. We're going to have a prayer team in the back in just a moment, and I want to, if you feel as though God has been praying, or as God has been speaking to you today, I want you to take a step and to pray with somebody or to go back to the prayer team. But here's the thing, guys, you need to want that more than you don't want to walk to the back or turn to your neighbor and ask for prayer. You need to want the life that Jesus has for you, the abundant free life. You need to be convinced that you need him, or there will be no room in your heart. The beautiful thing about these promises is that they set us free not to live under bondage or slavery anymore, but instead to live this full, beautiful, amazing new life with new identity and no more pressure to perform. Let me pray for you guys. Jesus, I pray for myself first and foremost as I approach you. I don't think there's ever been a time in my life when I didn't actually believe that I had to work to earn the acceptance and the love that I have from you. I don't think there's been a time in my life where I haven't struggled to believe that there is nothing that I can do that would separate me from your love. And there's nothing that I could do that would increase your love for me because it's already maxed. Lord, I pray for the hearts of the people in this room. I pray that you would be penetrating them, that you'd be speaking to them, that they would sit and feel as though you are actually saying these words directly to them. And if that is them, I pray their face would burn up. I pray that they would feel warm and hot and they would just know that you're speaking to them and that they would need to turn to somebody and pray. We were not made to do this alone. We were made to be in community. We were made to be in support with one another. Lord, I pray for freedom from slavery and bondage here today. I pray that as we walk out of these doors, we walk into a new life, a better life, one that's directly connected in an open relationship with you. Lord, I pray all these things in your name.